These days, I'm hearing fewer and fewer pastors, school teachers, and youth workers praising parents for doing a great job with their kids. And more, I'm reading research that laments the loss of absolutes, the lack of discipline, the increase in entitlement, and a decline in mental health among our children and teens. One of the clear causal factors feeding these trends is a decline in effective parenting. But there is hope. Christian parents can break out of the cultural flow and reassert their authority in ways that will lead kids to healthy spiritual, physical, and emotional growth. Join us as we chat with one of the most insightful voices guiding us into an understanding of what it means to parent well, Dr. Leonard Sachs, as we chat about his best-selling book, The Collapse of Parenting, on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Youth Culture Matters. I'm Walt Mueller here at CPYU in our studios. In the middle of Pennsylvania, we've got Jason Sochenik's with me today from Spokane, Washington, to co-host. And we've got a good guest. Before we jump into that, Jason, watching culture, you know, we talk about this a lot in terms of who some of the best observers are of culture, not so much because they set out to observe culture, but because they're embedded in the culture. So I've often said, you know, school teachers, coaches, I've learned a lot from them. Where do you go, Jason? I mean, beyond that, is there anybody else that you've been looking at or asking, you know, hey, tell me about what's happening in a world of kids because you're embedded with them?
Yeah, I think another group that we could look at would be counselors.
Yeah.
I think counselors, most definitely, just hearing even from my wife and what she engages on a daily basis has been super helpful. And then youth workers. I mean, youth workers, especially those that are doing a ton of contact work where they're going out, spending time in the schools, in the trenches, doing life with youth. I just find that I learn a lot from them.
Yeah. Well, one of the additional great resources that we can tap into in terms of people who spend time with children, with teens, with parents, with families, would be physicians. And one of the physicians that's really been helpful to me in understanding the culture, and someone who, when I read what he's writing, my heart leaps because he's just, you know, his observations are right on, is Dr. Leonard Sachs. And Dr. Leonard Sachs is our guest today. He is a practicing family physician, a psychologist, and an author. He's written several books. Girls on the Edge is one of them. Boys Adrift, another. A book I know you've read that I still have yet to read, Jason, is Why Gender Matters. Dr. Sachs has written that. And the book we're going to talk about today is a book I picked up a couple of years ago that, again, my heart was leaping as I read it. He just nails it in here and offers great responses. It's a book called The Collapse of Parenting, How We Hurt Our Kids When We Treat Them Like Grown-Ups, The Three Things You Must Do to Help Your Child or Teen Become a Fulfilled Adult. So, Dr. Sachs, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm just going to mention this because, you know, I have to. Jason is, we often joke about sports here. Jason's a Chicago Bears fan. I just want to mention, because I'm sure you're wondering, Jason, Dr. Sachs is an Eagles fan. So that's another, you know, good check mark on his pedigree there. So
that's excellent.
Yeah.
I'm happy to know that I'm surrounded by Eagles fans
there
and
you
one
go.
Eagles fan.
Yeah.
Even separate sports, but that's fine.
We suffer.
They're evil empires.
Yes,
that's fine.
Yes. Well, Dr. Sachs, let's jump into a conversation about this book. And I want to say this is not only a great book for parents to read, but youth workers and folks in the church as well. Pastors, I think, should be reading this. School teachers should be reading this because so much will resonate with them. And you don't just offer observations. You know, you get prescriptive. We'll talk about that at some point here. But talk a little bit about the title, The Collapse of Parenting, and what has driven you to write this.
Well, I've been a medical doctor in the United States now for 33 years, and I have seen a big change in how parents interact with their kids. So I'll give you an example. I was talking to parents in Chappaqua, New York, which is an affluent suburb of New York City, and talking about the explosion in obesity among American kids. In 1971, 4% of American kids were obese. Today, more than 18% of American kids are obese. Why did that happen? It happened for a number of reasons, but one of which was that there was a change in how meals are prepared. So I was talking to this group in Chappaqua, and afterwards, mom and dad told me how they had made a healthy, nutritious supper for their son and daughter. And their son and daughter came home, and they said, "Ooh, yuck, we don't eat that. Can we just order pizza?" And so dad sat down at the computer, and the son dictated his order for his pizza. Daughter dictated her order for her pizza, and takeout pizza from Domino's was delivered to their home. And I said to dad, "Why did you do that?" I said, "Why didn't you just tell them this is what's for supper?" And dad said, "Well, I don't believe in using starvation as a means of discipline." I said, "Look, they're not going to starve. Look, 40 years ago, if mom made a healthy and nutritious supper and the kids didn't like it, she did not run out and buy them a pizza. She would say, this is what's for supper. If you don't like it, you can go to bed hungry." 40 years ago, parents decided what's for supper. Increasingly in the United States, parents ask their kids, "What do you want for supper?" Well, when you ask a 12-year-old what they want for supper, there are some 12-year-olds who will say broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, cauliflower, spinach, asparagus, and kale. But there are many 12-year-olds who will say pizza, french fries, potato chips, and ice cream. Mm-hmm. If you let kids decide what's for supper, well, many kids are not competent to make that call. That's why they have parents. But when parents abdicate that responsibility, one result, not the most important result, but one of many bad results, is you get a lot more fat kids.
Hmm. This reminds me, we mentioned that news story a couple of months ago, and I'm trying to remember where that was. That out of the UK? There was a story, and I don't know, Dr. Sachs, if you saw this or not, but a story about a young man who was in the midst of a major health crisis, and they found out that all he had been eating for the great majority of his life was, what was it, potato chips?
Pringles, yes. Sausage.
Yeah.
Yes. And the parents, I did see that story, and the parents insisted, "Well, he just can't eat anything else."
Yeah.
and they don't understand. It's not that he can't. It's that he doesn't want to.
Yeah.
And basically he throws a tantrum if you try to feed him a vegetable. And that's taking it to the extreme, that story, because that kid is now profoundly malnourished because humans will not do well on a diet of pizza, potato chips, and french fries.
Yeah.
But it was really striking that even though their son is now severely malnourished, the parents still don't get it and still are defending their choice to let him make the call that he gets to choose what he eats. And I opened my book, The Collapse of Parenting, describing a story from my own practice where this affluent family, mom brings in her daughter. She says, "My daughter's had this rash at the corners of her mouth for weeks, and we've tried every kind of cream. Nothing works." And I took a careful look, and I said, "Well, this is a problem we see fairly often. It is a vitamin deficiency. Your daughter is not getting enough B2 from green vegetables." And I looked at the girl. I said, "You know, do you eat green vegetables?" And she laughed. And mom said, "Well, basically all she'll eat right now is it's pizza and french fries." And daughter interrupted and said, "And it has to be McDonald's french fries." And this is an affluent family with the girl who's overweight. She is overweight but malnourished.
Yeah.
You can get a lot of calories from pizza and french fries, but you're not being well nourished. And again, as a family doctor, I'm seeing this more and more often, that parents who have plenty of money, enough money to feed their child healthy, are not, because they're letting their kid make the call.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, what you're describing and what I've read from you in the book really is symptomic of a crisis of authority.
Well, the examples I've given are a little more extreme, and parents will say, "Oh, well, you know, I would never do that. In my family, we eat very healthy." But there are other examples of the same phenomenon. So when I meet with parents, I say, okay, your teenager has a smartphone. No smartphones in the bedroom. At 9 o'clock, the very latest, you take the phone from your kid, you switch it off, and you put it in the charger, which from now on is going to stay in the parent's bedroom. She can have it back tomorrow morning. And parents who are boasting about how healthy their family eat, now their faces blanch, and they're like, oh, I couldn't take her phone from her. She'd totally freak out. And I'm saying, look, this is your job. It is not fair to put this burden in on your daughter's lap. What's your teenage daughter supposed to say tomorrow in school when her friend says, hey, I texted you last night at midnight. How come you didn't answer? Is your daughter supposed to say, well, researchers have found that sleep deprivation in adolescence is a major risk factor in the etiology of depression? That's ridiculous. You can't expect a teenage girl to talk that way. You got to allow her to say, hey, my evil parents take my phone every night at 9. We'll only have back for the next morning. This is your job. So I was speaking to parents, and I was saying, you got to take the phone at 9 o'clock that day, just turn it off, put it in charge, it stays in the parent's bedroom. Those are the guidelines of the American Academy of Pediatrics. And during Q&A, a father said, he said, Dr. Sachs, I get what you said about kids not being on their phone all night long and need to get a good night's sleep. I get that. I totally agree with that, he said. But, you know, my daughter, she puts her phone in airplane mode at bedtime so that she will not be interrupted or get a text at 2 in the morning. But then she can still use her phone as her alarm clock. And she switches it back into regular mode when she wakes up in the morning. And I said to Dad, how do you know that she keeps it in airplane mode? How do you know that she doesn't take it out of airplane mode after you leave the room? And Dad was clearly offended. And he said, Dr. Sachs, you're suggesting my daughter would lie to me. My daughter would never lie to me. And I said, sir, I don't know you and I don't know your daughter, but I can tell you based on the research, your daughter is more likely to lie to you than to anyone else because she cares what you think, because she doesn't want to disappoint you. Look, there's great wisdom in the Lord's Prayer. Jesus said, lead us not into temptation. He did not say, make us strong to resist temptation. He didn't say that because Jesus knew the human heart. And he knew that if you put temptation before someone, they will fall. Don't put that stumbling block in your daughter's path. No phones in the bedroom. You know, a lot of parents who are doing real good with the healthy, nutritious suppers are not doing so good with the no devices in the bedroom. Mm. You know, T.S. Eliot has a wonderful line. T.S. Eliot became a devout Christian towards the end of his life. And he wrote about the spiritual walk. And he, in one of his poems, he said, where can the word be heard? Question mark. Not here. He said, there is not enough silence. Not enough silence. In order to have any kind of meaningful spiritual walk, you have to have a moment of silence where you can listen and not talk, not be entertained, but listen. I got a whole thing I do on 1 Kings 19:12, where Elijah is in the cave. And he's told God is about to pass by, and there was an earthquake, and then a mighty wind and a fire, but God was not in the earthquake or the mighty wind or the fire. And then came Kol Demama Daka, that's the Hebrew. And that is often translated something like a still small voice, but that's not what the Hebrew actually says. The Hebrew says a voice of absolute silence, a voice of silence. Mm. You hear the Lord often in a voice of silence. You will not hear it if you're constantly entertained with your TikTok and your YouTube videos. Where can the word be heard? Not here. There's not enough silence. And nighttime is the natural time when you're in your bedroom with the door closed and the lights out and it is silent. Nobody falls asleep instantly. We all have those minutes. And that's where you can listen. Mm. But not if you got your phone.
Yeah.
And you're following the text until you fall asleep at 2 in the morning. Parents are astonished to find that half the ninth grade class is awake and texting at 2 in the morning because Jason just broke up with Emily. OMG, this is really big news. We have to talk about this.
Jason just broke up with Emily. I love that. We've got Jason here who's married to Emily, so I'm glad you didn't say Walt just broke up with Lisa. That's awesome.
That was excellent.
Boy, this, you know, here's what I love about this conversation. Like, my head is spinning because you just popped the lid off of about 20 different avenues that we could go down here where we've been watching trends in youth culture. We've got great concern from, you know, a faith perspective, obviously. And so this is really, really good. Let me ask you a question. One of the Common Sense Media, and I don't know Dr. Sachs, if you're familiar with him or not.
I know it very well. Yeah. I always recommend it in my talks to parents.
Excellent. So maybe you saw this. So they came out with their Common Sense census, the most recent one.
Yes.
Yeah, in the last
few weeks.
Carefully. Yeah. So you saw that the tipping point now for let's talk about smartphones here for a minute because we're on the technology track. You saw where with the latest Common Sense census, the tipping point now for over 50% of children having a phone. It used to be age 13. So it was 50% 4 or 5 years ago at age 13. Now, 4 or 5 years later,
I believe,
53% at 11 years old.
Yeah.
Just comment on that because we've got parents who are listening. And this is a battle because, as you're saying, parents want to be their kid's friend, not a parent. So I don't want my kid to be left out. I'm going to get them the phone. And if the tipping point at 53% is 11 years old, what's happening with the 6, 7, and 8 year olds? There's way too many of those who have smartphones now. What are you seeing and what are you recommending on this?
Yeah.
Be direct.
So I think the research is very clear. No child under 13 should have a smartphone, meaning a phone that can surf the net, a phone that can take a picture and send a picture. And most 13-year-olds are not ready. And if you're going to give your teenager a smartphone, you must install on it a parental monitoring app so that you can see what they're doing and you explain to your kid, I will know what you're doing. Just a few days ago, the New York Times published a terrifying, detailed article of how 12 and 13-year-olds are going on Fortnite. They're playing Fortnite online. That's the most popular mode, is the Fortnite Battle Royale. They're playing online, which is basically social media, and they're making friends with other kids online. And then these other kids start talking to them. And this is a 12-year-old boy who's talking to a 12-year-old boy in Spokane, Washington. And they're talking and they're really having fun and they're exchanging these jokes. Or this 12-year-old girl is talking to a 12-year-old boy in Spokane, Washington. And then he says, well, can I see what you look like? And she sends her a picture. Can I see another picture? And before long, she's sending this 12-year-old boy a bunch of pictures, not realizing he's not a 12-year-old boy. He's a 32-year-old man. On the web, no one knows you're a dog, paraphrase the old New Yorker cartoon. And then she sends him an inappropriate picture, and he now blackmails her and says, if you don't send me more, I'm going to post this everywhere and everyone will see it. This is not a guess. This is happening more and more often. It has exploded just in the last 2 years. And there's nobody minding the store. Again, the 1994 Internet Act immunizes the websites. They are not liable for what happens, because Congress passed a law in 1994, way before anyone had any clue of what was actually going to happen online, way before Facebook existed, let alone Instagram or Fortnite. And so these websites are not liable for all the criminal behavior that's going on. And you can't figure out who that 12-year-old boy in Spokane is. He's not even a 12-year-old boy in Spokane. He's a 32-year-old man in Brooklyn, New York. But you don't know that. You have no easy way of finding that out. The only way parents can stay in front of this is if they see what's going on and they explain to their kid, you don't share personal information. You don't send a photo to anybody. You have no way of knowing who that guy is. It is not fair to put a 12-year-old in a situation where they are supposed to outwit a 31-year-old adult who is very skilled in using the technology, this 12-year-old has no idea. A 12-year-old cannot outwit a 31-year-old as a rule. If that 31-year-old is very tech savvy and the 12-year-old is not, it is not fair. It is not safe. Parents don't have a clue. They don't realize what this technology can do. You know, when I talk to parents about the dangers of video games, you talk to parents over 40, you talk to them about video games, they're thinking Pong and Pac-Man. They have no clue of what's going on with Fortnite or Call of Duty or any of these other online platforms that are also social media as well as being video game platforms.
Mm. I have to say that I take a little bit of offense to the fact that over 40, and I actually do know more than just Pong and Pac-Man.
Well, you're special.
We've said that about Jason all the time. You're special. That yeah, that's good. He's very insightful, Jason. Dr. Sachs, he knows what he's talking about.
He does. He does. Well, we're going to take a quick break, so that way we make sure we're staying on time. But I want to come back after the break because I think that we started this conversation with why you wrote this book, The Collapse of Parenting, and specifically hitting upon obesity. But I know that there are some other elements, too, yes. And we've talked about some of them. And I would like to make sure we do that. But we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come right back and continue our conversation with Dr. Sachs.
Are you interested in bringing CPYU to your church, school, or community? A big part of our ministry is the on-site seminars we conduct in dozens of settings every year. CPYU seminars are designed to encourage and educate your audience on a variety of youth culture issues. Every seminar is designed to be informative, practical, and hope-filled. If you want to learn more about our CPYU seminars, available speakers, and the many seminar topics and options in our growing seminar lineup, go to our CPYU homepage at cpyu.org. Click on the seminar option on the menu bar at the top of the page, and you can learn more about how to schedule a CPYU speaker and seminar for your parents, youth workers, and educators.
Thank you for listening to Youth Culture Matters. We're here with Dr. Sachs talking about his book, The Collapse of Parenting, and we are just diving right back in. We ended our break talking about that the book really hit upon a lot more than just obesity. Could you just maybe expand some of the many things that you identified as problems? I think that in your book you identified five.
Well, sure, but it's pretty basic. So, you know, as I said, I've been a medical doctor in the United States more than 30 years, and as recently as 20 years ago, it was common for parents to say to kids things like, do unto others. You know, that's not a suggestion, that's a command. But over the last 20 years, I've seen that command soften, morph into a question. And the question is often something like, well, you know, how would you feel if someone did that to you? And the parent has no idea what to say when a son answers, if someone did that to me, I'd kick him in the nuts and then I'd sit on his face. Deuteronomy chapter 6. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. And these words which I command you this day shall be upon your heart. And what? The next line is usually translated something like, and you shall teach them diligently to your children. That's not actually what the Hebrew says. The Hebrew is vishinantam levinecha. It would be easy to say, teach them diligently. In Hebrew, the verb would be lamed, to teach, but that's not the verb. The verb in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 7 is shanan. What does shanan mean? Shanan means to chisel in stone. So a better translation of Deuteronomy 6, 7 would be incise them, inscribe these words on the hearts of your children. On the very next page, so you find that exegesis of Deuteronomy 6 in my book, The Collapse of Parenting, page 133. On the very next page, I quote from a regular columnist to the New York Times, Jennifer Finney Boylan. So Jennifer Finney Boylan writes this column for the New York Times on enlightened parenting. And she says, and I'm quoting now her exact words. She says, enlightened parenting means, quote, setting your child free to discover for themselves their own right and wrong. And if in so doing, your child becomes a stranger to you, then so be it, end quote. That may seem enlightened, but it is not. It is a dereliction of duty. You know, what is childhood for? I mean, quite literally, what is childhood for? A four-year-old horse is a mature adult. The Kentucky Derby is raced with three-year-olds. So it can't be about just physical maturity, because a four-year horse is a bigger animal than a human, and a four-year-old horse is fully mature at 4 years of age. A four-year-old human has barely begun. Why is human childhood and adolescence so long? Humans are children and adolescents for more years than most animals live. Why? We don't have to guess. We have scholars who study this question, and I cite them, and the answer they give is that human childhood is as long as it is because it takes many years for parents to teach right and wrong to the kids. That New York Times recommendation to set your child free to discover their own right and wrong is profoundly unhuman. It's not what we are wired to do as humans. We are hardwired to inscribe those words, to incise them on the hearts of our children. Vichinantam levenecha. That is the Jewish and Christian tradition. That has been the Western tradition for over 2,000 years. And we now have these New York Times columnists, these professors of education, who tell us we should set our kid loose. It's crazy. It is not motivated by data. It's motivated by ideology. Mm. The data show very clearly, and I cite the longitudinal cohort studies in my book, show very clearly that kids who have authoritative parents, parents who are teaching right and wrong with love, those kids have much better outcomes than permissive parents. The children of permissive parents are much more likely to abuse drugs and alcohol, to get in trouble with the law. This is not a guess, and it's not a sermon. It's a robust empirical finding. And yet we have these modern-day preachers, like the New York Times columnists, who are very proud of having no religious affiliation, but who are preaching this secular gospel to set your child loose, literally to be a permissive parent. Set your child loose to discover their own right and wrong. I can't think of a better description of permissive parenting than setting your child loose to discover their own right and wrong. And yet the New York Times publishes this as something parents should do, when we know, based on the research, this is putting your child at risk.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that you, just a few minutes ago, when you started to talk about this, you mentioned the professors, you know, university professors who are teaching this. And we, in a reading group we have here at CPYU, we've got about 500 people who read together over the course of a book every 2 months. And we recently read The Coddling of the American Mind.
Oh, excellent book.
Yeah, Greg Lukianoff. Well. Yeah, so good. And it's interesting to me to see that the very thing that they're teaching is now coming full circle back to bite them on the university campus and in the classroom, and even the most left-leaning, we would say, that those who would embrace what you're lamenting here, those who would embrace this the most, are now seeing the results of that in the classroom, in the fact that they're handcuffed in terms of being able to teach, because of trigger warnings, microaggressions. Yep.
And it's really undermining the whole educational enterprise. You know, the first chapter of my book, The Collapse of Parenting, is titled The Culture of Disrespect, where I present the evidence that American popular culture, by which I mean the culture of Bruno Mars, Miley Cyrus, Childish Gambino, Akon, Eminem, 50 Cent, Kim Kardashian, is now a culture that presents disrespect as cool, as funny, and it profoundly undermines the educational enterprise, because if a child or teenager is going to learn, they have to respect the professor. They have to acknowledge that the teacher knows more than they do, and that the teacher might have something worthwhile to teach them. But how are they supposed to do that in the culture of Bruno Mars and Justin Bieber, which is all about making fun of the grown-ups, that the grown-ups don't know anything worth learning? I'm also a big fan of Peggy Noonan, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. And she recently had a wonderful article that she concluded about choosing the right university. And she said, you don't want to go to a quote-unquote top-tier university anymore, because they have just become indoctrination, schools of indoctrination, where you learn that you should set everyone loose to discover for themselves their own right and wrong. They are schools for left-of-center indoctrination. You want to choose what most people consider a second-tier university. That's the phrase she used. And preferably a school with a religious affiliation. And she talked about visiting these schools and how impressed she has been that at these quote-unquote second-tier schools, the focus is still on learning, on discovering what is true, and on listening to the professor. My good friend from Lomond Elementary School, we were best friends 50 years ago, Keith Gandel, now teaches at the City College, New York. And he says the great majority of his students are immigrants, very few of them come from affluent families. Most of them are first in their family to go to college. And I asked him about the coddling of the American mind, the book you just read, and about how so many universities now are finding they're hamstrung by political correctness, that they can't have an honest conversation about anything. He said that's not true at City College, a quote-unquote second-tier college. We can talk about anything we want. He's heard about this at the elite universities like Columbia, which is very nearby, incidentally, where he teaches. But it's not at the second tier. They're still many of them are still able to do to learn instead of being indoctrinated.
Yeah, that's good. Hey, would you comment on? As we talk about this, I get to thinking about university students, and you know, you're working with families with younger children, teenagers, and then they you know move on to the next. Well, maybe this is my question: is they don't move on to the next phase of life. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing in terms of you know extended adolescence or what some call emerging adulthood?
Yeah, so 50 years ago, it was very, very rare for a 25-year-old able-bodied man not to be working and not to be looking for work. That has exploded. We're seeing more and more able-bodied men in their 20s who are living at home, not working and not looking, and not working and not looking for work. 2006, a movie came out called Failure to Launch, starring Matthew McConaughey, where he plays this handsome, funny, friendly young man who is living in his parents' home in his early 30s, not working, not really working, and not looking for work. And he says to his friends, he says, it's going to take a stick of dynamite to get me out of my parents' home. And I wrote an op-ed about this for the Washington Post because I said, I am seeing this. This movie was an unexpected hit. It was a small budget film, not much marketing, was number one in the United States for 4 weeks, unexpected hit. And I wrote about it for the Washington Post. I said, the reason this movie is resonating is because I'm seeing this. In fact, we all know someone like this now. A young man who's smart, who's funny, who could be doing a lot, but he's not motivated. I talked about in my own practice, this mom confronts her son one day and she says, you know, what's the story here? You wake up late every morning, you work a few hours a week at the coffee shop, you're 27 years old. You don't have a real job. You don't even have a girlfriend. And he laughed. He said, well, I used to have a girlfriend. Then she found out I only work a couple hours a week at Starbucks. She dumped me. And mom was like, well, duh, you know, what young woman wants to be with a man who's got no ambition beyond earning enough money to pay for his video games? She insisted he come meet with me, and he did. He said some very, very unkind things about this young woman. He said she was fat. She wanted me to take her place to do stuff. He said, $19.95 a month. I said, wait. What do you mean, $19.95 a month? I don't understand what you're talking about. What's $19.95 a month? And he mentioned a porn site, pornography. He said, $19.95 a month, and the girls are way prettier. I said, wait, those aren't girls. Those are pictures on a computer screen. Wouldn't you rather be intimate with an actual woman? And he said, no. He's very happy in his bedroom with his video games and his pornography, and he's 27 years old. His parents are pulling their hair out. And this is becoming more and more common. 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, it would have been really unusual to find a young man, 27 years old, able-bodied, who's working just a few hours a week at a coffee shop and not looking for a real job. Today, it's becoming increasingly common. And so I wrote a book called Boys Adrift. And the subtitle is The Five Factors Driving the Growing Epidemic of Unmotivated Boys and Underachieving Young Men. Because it's not just about men in their 20s. At every stage, K through 12 education, we're finding that girls are now doing better than their brothers in terms of grades at every, in every grade, in every subject, including math and science. Girls now outperform boys. That was not true 20 years ago. It is true today. What's going on? Well, there's a lot of things going on. There are five separate factors. But one is that this girl wants to get good marks, and her brother is much more interested in being the first in his group to finish all the missions in Call of Duty Modern Warfare. And if you get, if you're a 14-year-old boy today and you get, you're the first in your group to finish all the missions in Call of Duty Modern Warfare, you are going to greatly raise your status in the eyes of the other boys. If you're a 14-year-old boy in the United States today and you get an A instead of a B on Spanish, you're not going to raise your status in the eyes of the boys. You might lower your status. You don't want them to know that. I do a lot of workshops for schools, and I was at this K through 8 school in Hamilton, Ontario, and the principal was telling me how he saw this second grade girl, a grade 2 girl, walking out of the school with this ridiculous pile of books that were obviously not books for second graders. They're middle school textbooks. And he said to the girl, "What are you doing with those books? Whose books are those?" She said, "Were they my brother's books, and he gave me $1 to take his books home." So this is a boy in seventh grade, grade 7, who actually, unlike most of the other boys, actually does want to study. But he doesn't want anyone to see him taking his books home, because that is so uncool for a boy to be taking his books home in order to study. That will lower yours. That's the culture we now live in, where it is uncool for a boy to be a scholar. That's a big change. You know, I mentioned a generation ago, Sam Cooke had a number one hit song in the United States. He sang, "Don't Know Much About History." He sang, "Now I don't claim to be an A student, but I'm trying to be. Because maybe by being an A student baby, I could win your love for me." He goes on to mention French, geometry, and trigonometry as subjects in which he's going to try harder to earn an A rather than a B, because he believes that by earning an A, he will raise his status in the eyes of the pretty girl. And that was characteristic of American culture 50 years ago. 50 years ago, American popular culture was the culture of Simon and Garfunkel, the Beatles. It was cool now we are in the culture of Akon. You know, Akon, A-K-O-N, chose the name Akon to remind you of his claim. He claims to be a con. He claims to be a convicted felon. He claims to have served 2 years for Grand Theft Auto in the Georgia State Penitentiary, a claim which turns out to be false. When he got to be famous, the reporters looked it up and they found that, well, he was arrested once on a charge of possession of one item of stolen property. Those charges were quickly dismissed. He's never been convicted of anything, and he's never been inside a penitentiary except to perform. American popular culture has changed from a culture in which young men want you to think they were scholars working hard to earn an A rather than a B, to a culture in which many young men would like you to think they're convicted felons or gang members, even if they are not. That's a significant change.
Dr. Sachs, thank you. I do have one question that I find relates to what you're talking about, and that's specifically around entrepreneurial. You spoke about how the economy is shifting where it's less entrepreneurial than ever before. And I think this fits a little bit with what you've been just now talking about. Which actually I found surprising, because I felt like maybe this next generation is actually moving into a space where they are more entrepreneurial than maybe the generation before it. And so can you speak to that? Because it seems like what you're talking yeah. about is along those lines. Is I know you brought it up when you were speaking about fragility, but I'm just very interested in whether or not you think that this is continuing to exist, or if it's changing and how it relates to what we just talked about.
Well, indeed, many Americans assume that our economy, our culture is becoming more entrepreneurial, but the data show just the opposite. There has actually been a collapse in entrepreneurship in the United States over the last 20 years, a dramatic decline in the rate at which young people, especially people in their 20s and early 30s, are starting new businesses. Most Americans don't know this. Most Americans assume it's otherwise because we're immersed in stories of Zuckerberg and these young people starting these enormously successful startups. Those stories are not typical. There has been a collapse of entrepreneurship among young Americans. There has been a collapse of creativity among young Americans. And that's documented. We have valid measures of creativity. We've been administering the same test to teenagers and young people for 20, 30 years. We can look at the trend lines, and the trend lines are dramatic, and they are uniquely American. The original title of my book, The Collapse of Parenting, was The Collapse of American Parenting. Mm-hmm. And the subtitle was Why Most Kids Would Now Be Better Off Raised Outside the United States. But non-celebrity authors don't get to choose their titles or subtitles. And I really fought back. I don't like the subtitle they chose, which is something about how you shouldn't allow your kids to act like grown-ups. I think that's a terrible subtitle. I think many times you should expect your child to be mature and self-controlled, characteristics that we expect of grown-ups. And I pleaded with the publisher for a different subtitle, but non-celebrity authors don't get to choose their subtitle. But I think in many settings, you do need to require kids, expect kids to be self-controlled and mature, and challenge them to be self-controlled and mature in an age-appropriate way.
Mm, that's so good. Hey, we need to take a break real quick. Stick with us, everybody. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Dr. Leonard Sachs. Someone once told me that readers are leaders and leaders are readers. I'm convinced that one of the most important disciplines for youth workers and parents is reading. I've also found that reading and discussing books together has helped me not only stay on a reading schedule, but to consider things that I might not have noticed on my own. That said, I want to invite you to join a reading community where together we read noteworthy and provocative books on important matters related to faith and culture. Our CPYU Reading and Discussion Group can be found on Facebook. Almost 500 people are a part of the group, and we'd love to have you join us. We read and discuss one book every 2 months. Just search on Facebook for the CPYU Reading Discussion Group and then request to join. I'd love to have you join us. Well, welcome back, everybody. We're having a, boy, this is a good conversation, and just has my head spinning as we talk to Dr. Leonard Sachs. He's written several books. I want to remind everybody, the one we're talking about now is The Collapse of Parenting. He's written a book about girls, Girls on the Edge. He's written one about boys, Boys Adrift, and then one on gender, all the confusion that's out there now on that, why gender matters. And Chris Wagner here in our office, when we post this, if you go to the player on our website, cpyu.org, for this particular episode of the podcast, underneath the player you will see links that Chris has posted to everything that we mentioned here, including all of Dr. Sachs's books. And Dr. Sachs, I want to ask you as well, do you have a website?
Yes, it's just my name, leonardsachs.com, and listeners can send me an email via that website.
Okay, great. So you can not only find out more about what Dr. Sachs is doing, but actually send me an email. And I'm guessing, I know you're doing a lot of seminars, you're doing a lot of speaking, so if you want to have Dr. Sachs come to your community, to your church, you can contact him through that as well. So, and just a reminder for those who may access the podcast through other, you know, platforms, podcast platforms, go back to cpyu.org, and that's where you'll find the player with all these things. And again, a little shameless plug here. We always say this, you know, subscribe to Youth Culture Matters wherever you get your podcasts. So I want to ask you now about some very – you've given us a ton of practical responses, but ask you to focus a little now on some responses, some prescriptive ideas and things that you would recommend for – let's talk about youth workers first, and then I want to go to parents. This is a great way to close it out in our last segment here.
So I do a workshop for youth pastors and other people in a church setting who work with especially teenagers. It's very common across the United States that kids' engagement with the church community pretty much ends or is scaled back after confirmation. But it's those years after confirmation, the high school years, where kids really need the church community the most. Well, in what sense do they need it? And what can and should the church be doing? That's kind of where we begin that workshop for the youth pastors. Well, we start by looking at what many churches are doing. And unfortunately, what many churches are doing is not best practice. I rely a lot on the work of Christian Smith, a sociologist who has studied churches across the United States. And he has found that at many churches across the United States, the youth group means ninth grade girls and ninth grade boys having a pizza party, which is not what they need. It may be what they think they want. And again, the churches have been infected by this American culture of market research. And the churches are asking the kids, what do you guys want? And they say, well, let's have a pizza party. And so that's what the church is offering them. The church can and should do so much more. So I've discussed this many times over the years with Reverend Alan James, who is now retired, was a pastor for many decades for the Lutheran Church near Stillwater, Minnesota. And he told me how for many, many years, his church offered summer, or I should say his church arranged summer excursions. So the Namekagon River runs from the headwaters down to the St. Croix, the river that divides Wisconsin from Minnesota. And the Namekagon is a beautiful, beautiful river. And the National Park Service maintains that, what they call scenic waterway, and they have campsites along the rivers. So 3 days and two nights, you get 16 girls with 16 women. And they begin, and that first morning, one girl goes with one woman, not her mother, in a canoe, and they paddle down for 2 hours, pull off at lunch, and all the girls and women meet for lunch, make lunch together. Then, after lunch is done at one of these designated campsites that the National Park Service maintains, very beautiful along the river, you get back in, the girl gets back in the canoe now with a different woman, and you go another 2 hours downriver. Till you pull off for the campsite that they've designated to be their evening, and they gather brush, they make a fire, they cook their common supper together, they sit around the campfire and tell stories, Reverend James told me so many stories about how powerful this was to create a community of women for girls. And they do the same thing with the boys, to create a community of men for boys. Strong bonds across generations. That's a characteristic of every healthy community. And it used to be a characteristic of us. And by us, I mean Americans who speak English at home. We don't have to guess on this point. We've got scholars who found that 50 years ago, boys and men would gather to work under the hood of a car. This was very common. Today, it is very rare. You drive around a community today, you might see two old geezers working at the head of their 65 Corvette, but the boys are not with them. The bonds across generations have been broken. We must restore them. That's what the church youth group must do. It must restore bonds across generations. And it doesn't cost them anything to do this. You just invite middle-aged men and older men, retirees, to come in and talk to the boys. And I cite another example where they did this, and the leader stepped out of the room, and he came back, and all the boys were sitting around this 78-year-old electrician who was telling them stories from 50 years ago when his buddy got electrocuted. And he said, when you're approaching any kind of electrical equipment, you never touch it with your palm. Because that's what happened to his buddy. It was live, and when you touch it with your palm, it grabs you, and he was electrocuted. You always touch it with the back of your hand. So if it's live, you can yank your hand away. And the boys were sitting in a circle, and the leader told me, he said, I saw a tribe being formed. You will find that boys are very ready to listen to grandfathers, to men much older than they are. The girls are very ready to listen to grandmothers. We need to create these bonds across generations. So when I meet with youth pastors, I share what I have learned from visiting over 400 schools and churches over the last 18 years about churches that are doing this successfully. It doesn't cost you anything. But you must do this. You must create a community of women for girls and a community of men for boys. The pizza party, ninth grade girls and boys hanging out together eating pizza, it might be what they think they want, but it's not what they need.
Yeah. You know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking one of the mantras I've been repeating over and over again, and more strongly as the days, the weeks, the years go on, that generates looks of like I'm from another planet, is when I talk to youth workers or to parents and I say to them, you know, if in the church we are not engaging in intergenerational worship experiences, but rather we're separating by the age groups and, you know, we arrive, but we separate, we're never together, we are undermining, you know, the spiritual health of not only the young people who can benefit from the wisdom of the older folks, but which is what you're talking about, but also the older folks who would benefit from having the young people in the room. Yep. And we're just dividing ourselves and yep. and caving to this cultural yep. reality.
Yeah, another point I make in three of my books is that what girls need in order to become women of faith is different from what boys need in order to become men of faith. And again, that's not a guess. So the last three chapters of my book, Girls on the Edge, the last three chapters are mind, body, and spirit. In that last chapter, spirit, I present all this research that scholars have done. I didn't even know there was such research. I started studying this. But this is good peer-reviewed research showing that what a girl needs to become a woman of faith is very different from what a boy needs to become a man of faith. The one thing they have in common is that the girl must be with a community of women. And the boy must be with a community of men. That's the one thing that is true in both cases. And so you want that campfire setting where you've got girls and women around a campfire and you've got boys and men around a campfire. The stories that are told will be very different stories. The women tell the girls very different stories from what the stories the men tell the boys. That's fine. What a boy needs is different from what a girl needs, but they all need strong connection across generations. We know this, and yet most churches are not doing it. Most churches are having the teenagers go over here to the youth group, and the men's group is actually this geriatric collection of Lions Club guys who are in their 70s, and it's such a shame. Because those teenage boys could really learn from those men in their 70s. And instead we segregate them in these age groups where they are sterile, where they cannot interact with one another.
Mm. And I'm guessing too, as I listen to you talk, you would really push back on the ways that we're allowing this commitment to gender neutrality and fostering gender neutrality. You would really push back on that sneaking into the church.
Well, certainly, because again, as C.S. Lewis said, in the church, we abandon the pretense and the costumes, and we acknowledge reality. And the reality, so when I speak on this topic, we always start with Genesis chapter 1, verse 27. In the image of God, Mm-hmm. He created him. Male and female, he created them. It doesn't say black and white, he created them. It doesn't say Asian and Hispanic, he created them. Those are man-made categories. But male and female are of God. And that's not a sermon. Again, that's a robust empirical finding. So I wrote an article earlier this year for Psychology Today describing this study just published earlier this year. An astonishing study in which researchers managed to do MRI scans on the brains of babies still in their mother's wombs, prenatal, prior to birth, and found dramatic differences in the wiring of the brain comparing boys with girls. You are born male or female. That's not a guess, and it's not a sermon. It is a robust empirical finding. This push to pretend that gender is merely a performance, which is the claim made by Judith Butler at Berkeley, who's a saint of the secular left, has received every honor that can be awarded an American professor. Judith Butler claims that gender is nothing other than and nothing more than a performance, that we all do gender and we all want to be creative and do it in our own way. So we're going to create our own gender, which could be male, female, some blend, gender queer, gender fluid. Okay, Judith Butler is a professor of comparative literature. She knows nothing about the brain. And when I have argued this point with some of these professors, and I'll say, well, what about this new research showing these dramatic, profound, and hardwired differences in the brains of baby girls compared with baby boys? They have no interest. They are not only ignorant, they have no curiosity. They are quite certain that anyone who believes that male and female are real categories, that any such person is either an idiot, a Republican, or both. And they are utterly uninterested in hearing anything about that astonishing MRI scan study of babies in their mother's rooms received no coverage in the mainstream press. Mm. It was a powerful study published in a peer-reviewed journal, not mentioned anywhere in the mainstream press because it contradicts the dominant story in the United States today, which is Judith Butler's claim. Again, the mainstream story that you'll get on CNN or any of most of the mainstream media is that gender is merely a performance, that we all learn how to create gender and we create it any way we want to. Scientific studies that directly contradict that claim are not mentioned. So I encourage, if I can put in a plug of my own, go to my website, leonardsass.com, sign up for my newsletter, my free monthly newsletter, and I will keep you apprised of these studies, as I did for the people on my listserv earlier this year, to let them know there's some astonishing research out there. You will not see it on television. You will not hear about it on NPR, but it's out there and it's important.
Dr. Sachs, thank you. I know that I'll sign up for that newsletter just specifically because these are important conversations. And I think one of the as you were talking about the church, I also was just wondering what it might mean for parents. So if you were to give some encouraging words or a word of advice to parents that are listening, what might those be in the midst of these conversations?
Absolutely. Well, that's what I do. And again, I've had the privilege of speaking to parents in many settings across the United States. And again, when I speak to parents, yeah, we look at the research, but it's always about very practical, concrete strategies. What can you do to improve the odds for your child? And I talk about the fact that in the United States today, the culture prioritizes friendships between kids. And it just permeates our whole culture that good parents help their kids be friends with other, you help your five-year-old be friends with other five-year-olds. And I find parents driving their kids from one play date to another and literally eating a meal on the way from one play date to another with their five-year-old. And the unintended message that parent is sending is that time at home with family is the lowest priority at all, of all, that it's more important to hang out with your kids your own age and be friends with them and be popular with them. And that's not only not helpful, that's really harmful. If kids come to think that popularity with their same age peers is important, that's a disaster. Because if it's important to you to be popular with same age peers, you're going to be anxious and depressed, because your popularity can change in one day, in 5 minutes, and every kid knows it. You want to see a teenage American girl have a total meltdown? Take her phone from her without warning, and she will totally freak out. She'll be like, Sonia doesn't know I don't have my phone. What happens if she texts me and I don't answer? She's going to think I'm ignoring her. She's going to think I don't like her. And you can go from being the most popular girl to being the odd girl out in 1 hour. They've all seen it happen. If you care about how popular you are with your friends, if that's really important to you, you will be anxious and depressed. And we have good research. So for example, a team from John Hopkins went nationwide across the United States in the 1960s, interviewing American kids and asking them, if these were American teens, and they asked them, if all of your friends wanted you to join a club and one of your parents did not approve, would you still join? In that era, a generation ago, the majority of American teens said no. I would not join, because the opinion of my parents matters more to me than the opinions of all my peers combined. Over the past many years, I have posed an updated version of Dr. Coleman's question to teenagers across the United States. I've said to them, if all your friends, when you sign up for a particular social media app, would you consult your parents first? And the most common answer I get from American teens today is not yes, it's not no, it's laughter. They burst out laughing. They're like, ha! My parents would probably think Ask FM is some kind of radio station. You know, why would I ask them? You know, they don't have a clue. These kids may say they love their parents, but the opinions of their peers matters more. And that's really harmful. Prioritize the family. What does that mean? It means you cancel the play date and you make a family date instead. It's more important for your 5-year-old or your 15-year-old to be spending their weekend with you than hanging out with their best friend. And again, many parents are like horrified, like, because they're now immersed in this culture that it's all about same age friendships. It should not be, again, because we got all this research showing that the parent-child relationship is way more important and way more lasting than the relationship your child will have with almost all of their peers. So what are some concrete strategies? No earbuds, no headsets in the car. When you get in the car, your child should be listening to you, and you should be listening to your child. She shouldn't have her headset on, her earbuds in, listening to Bruno Mars, Miley Cyrus. This is really toxic. When you plan a vacation and your daughter asks if her best friend can come along on the vacation, the answer is no. Because if her best friend comes along on the vacation, it's going to be her and her friend going up the mountain in the chairlift. And all you've done is to subsidize a very expensive play date. It needs to be you and your daughter in the chairlift. And when the chairlift stops and you're dangling 50 feet above ground, that's a great time to have a conversation. The point of the vacation is to strengthen bonds across generations. You can do this, but you'll have to be courageous, because again, your daughter's going to say, yeah, but Vanessa got to take her best friend with her. I understand that, but in our family, we prioritize the family, and that means it's just family on vacations.
This is so good. I know we've come to the end here, but What you were doing is you're calling us out of this water we're swimming in that we just has become so normal to us, to stand outside of the fishbowl and see what we're swimming in and see how dirty the water is, so to speak. And you're returning us to conventional wisdom that has really disappeared. And
yeah.
I love this. I love this. This is so good. You mentioned Dr. James, sociologist James Coleman, Johns Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that study, as well as many, many others, are contained in Dr. Sachs's book, The Collapse of Parenting. I won't read the subtitle. I agree with you on that. As you described that, I thought, yes, because I've been there with that, and I know how that works. And I just was imagining you talking to the publisher trying to get this change, building your case. But I love the title of the book, The Collapse of Parenting, because that really does clearly reflect so much of what's happened. So, again, thank you, Dr. Leonard Sachs, for joining us. And we are going to put all of the links up for this. Dr. Sachs has given us so many things, not only to think about, but to follow up with. I know we've had some folks tracking with us as we record this on Facebook, and they are making comments, and I know that they're taking notes as well. I know a lot of these folks, and they're going to follow up with this. So, Dr. Sachs, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you again for inviting me.
Yes. And Jason, thanks again for joining us. Chris Wagner, thank you for doing what you do here to make this all work for us. And for everyone who's listening, thanks for joining us. Check out this book, The Collapse of Parenting. And I will guarantee you we're going to have Dr. Leonard Sachs back on the podcast to talk about his other books as well. So until we get together again and we meet for the next episode of Youth Culture Matters, God bless you all.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.